5. The first dawn light was painting High Peak rose. It was going to be a beautiful day. Johnny Goodboy was completing the packing of a lead horse. Windsplitter was sidling about, biting at the grass but not really eating. He had his eye on Johnny. They were obviously going somewhere, and Windsplitter was not going to be left out. Some wisps of smoke were coming from the breakfast fire of the Jimson family nearby. They were roasting a dog. Yesterday at the funeral feast, nearly a score of dogs had gotten into an idiot fight. There had been plenty of bones and meat as well. But the pack had gotten into a fight, and a big brindle had been killed. Looked like the Jimson family would have meat all day. Johnny was trying to keep his mind on petty details, and off Chrissy and Patty, who were standing there watching him quietly. Brown Limper's staffer was also there, idling about in the background. He had a club foot and should have been killed at birth, but he was the only child the staffers had ever had, and staffer was parson after all. Maybe mayor, too, since there wasn't any now. There was no affection whatever between Johnny and Brown Limper. During the funeral dancing, Brown had sat on the sidelines making sneering remarks about the dancing, about the funeral, about the meat, about the strawberries. But when he had made a remark about Johnny's father, maybe never had a bone in the right place, Johnny had hit him a backhand cuff. Made Johnny ashamed of himself, hitting a cripple. Brown Limper stood crookedly, a faint blue bruise on his cheek, watching Johnny get ready, wishes of bad luck written all over him. Two other boys of similar age, there were only five in the whole village who were in their late teens, wandered up and asked Brown what was going on. Brown shrugged. Johnny kept his mind carefully on his business. He was probably taking too much, but he didn't know what he'd run into. Nobody knew. In the two buckskin sacks he was roping on either side of the lead horse, he had flint stones for fire, rat's nests for tinder, bundles of cut thongs, some sharp-edged rocks that were sometimes hard to find and cut indifferently well, three spare kill clubs, one heavy enough to crush a bear's skull just in case, some warm robes that didn't stink very much, a couple of buckskins for spare clothes. He gave a start. He hadn't realized Chrissy had come within a foot of him. He hoped he wouldn't have to talk. Blackmail, that's what it was. Plain as possible and all bad. If she'd said she would kill herself if he didn't come back, well, one could have put that down to girl vaporings. But threatening to follow him in a year put another shadow on it entirely. It meant he would have to be cautious. He'd have to be careful not to get himself killed. It was one thing to worry about his own life. He didn't care a snap for risk or danger. But the thought of Chrissy going down on the plains if he didn't come back made him snow cold at the pit of his stomach. She'd be gored or mauled or eaten alive, and every agonizing second of it would be Johnny's fault. She had effectively committed him to caution and care, just what she intended. She was holding something out to him, two somethings. One was a large bone needle with a thong hole in it, and the other was a skin awl. Both were worn and polished and valuable.
"They were Mama's," said Chrissy.
"I don't need anything."
"No, you have them."
"I won't need them."
"If you lose your clothes," she wailed, "how are you going to sew?"
The crowd had thickened. Johnny didn't need any outbursts. He snatched the needle and awl out of her hand and unlashed the neck of a sack and dropped them in, made sure they hadn't missed and dropped out, and then relashed the sack. Chrissy stood more quietly. Johnny turned and faced her. He was a little bit shocked. There wasn't even a smudge of color in her face. She looked like she hadn't slept and had tick fever as well. Johnny's resolution wavered. Then, beyond Chrissy, he saw Brown Limper tittering and talking behind his hand to Petey Tomso. Johnny's face went tight. He grabbed Chrissy and kissed her hard. It was as though he had taken a board from an irrigation trough. The tears went down her cheeks. "Now look," said Johnny, "don't you follow me." She made a careful effort to control her voice.
If you don't come back in a year, I will. By all the gods on High Peak, Johnny.
He looked at her. Then he beckoned to Windsplitter, who sidled over. With one smooth spring, he mounted, the lead rope of the other horse gripped in his hand. "You can have my other four horses," said Johnny to Chrissy. "Don't eat them. They're trained." He paused. "Unless you get awful hungry, of course, like in the winter." Chrissy hung on to his leg for a moment, and then she stepped back and sagged. Johnny thumped Windsplitter with a heel, and they moved off. This was going to be no wild, free ride to adventure. This was going to be a tiptoe scout with care. Chrissy had seen to that. At the entrance to the defile, he looked back. About 15 people were still standing there watching him go. They all looked dejected. He used a heel signal to make Windsplitter rear and waved his hand. They all waved back with sudden animation. Then Johnny was gone down the dark canyon trail to the wide and unknown plains. The rest of the people drifted off. Chrissy still stood there, hoping with a wild, crazy hope that he would ride into sight, returning. Patty tugged at her leg.
"Chrissy! Chrissy! Will he come back?"
Chrissy's voice was very low, her eyes like ashes in a dead fire.
"Goodbye," she whispered.
6. Turl belched. It was a polite way to attract attention, but the belch didn't make much impression through the whine and howl of machines in the transport department maintenance dome. Zitt's concentration on his work became more marked. Mindsight 16's transport chief had little use for the security head. Every time a tool or a car or fuel turned up missing, or something was broken, it got attention from security. 3 crashed cars were strewn about in various stages of reassembly, one of them very messy with splotches of green cyclo blood in the interior upholstery. The big drills that dangled from the ceiling rails pointed sharp beaks this way and that, idling in their programming. Lathes with nothing in their jaws spun, waiting for something to twist and shave. Belts snarled and slapped at each other. Turl watched the surprisingly nimble talons of Zitt disassemble the small concentric shells of a high-speed jet engine. Turl had hoped to detect a small tremble or two in Zitt's paws. If the transport chief's conscience was bothering him, it would be much easier to do business. There was no tremble. Zitt finished the disassembly and threw the last string on the bench. His yellow orbs contracted as he looked at Turl. "Well, what have I done now?" Turl lumbered closer and looked around. "Where are your maintenance men?" "Where 15 mechanics under complement. They were transferred to operations over the last month. I know it. And you know it. So why are you here?" As chief of security, Turl had learned through experience not to be very straightforward. If he simply asked for a manual reconnaissance plane, the transport chief would demand the emergency voucher, not get it, and say, "No transport." And there were no emergencies for security on this dull planet, not real ones. In hundreds of years of operation, there had not been the slightest security threat to intergalactic mining operations here. A dull security scene, and consequently the chief of that department was not considered very important. Apparent threats had to be manufactured with guile as their sole ingredient.
"I've been investigating a suspicion of conspiracy to sabotage transport," said Turl. "Kept me busy for the last 3 weeks."
He eased his bulk back against a wrecked car. "Don't lean on that recon. You'll dent its wing." Turl decided it was better to be friendly and rumbled over to a stool at the bench where Zitt was working.
"Confidentially, Zitt, I've had an idea that could get us some outside personnel. I'm working on it, and that's why I need a manual recon."
Zitt batted his eye bones and sat down on another stool, which creaked despairingly under his 1,000-pound bulk.
"This planet," said Turl confidingly, "used to have a sentient race on it. What race was that? Asked Zt suspiciously.
Man, said Turl.
Zt looked at him searchingly. A security officer was never noted for his sense of humor. Some had been known to bait and entrap and then file charges, but Zt couldn't help himself. His mouth bones started to stretch, and even though he sought to control them, they spread, and suddenly his laugh exploded in Turl's face. Zt hastily got it under control and turned back to his bench to resume work.
Anything else on your mind? Asked Zt, as an afterthought.
This was not going well, thought Turl. Well, that's what happened when you were frank. It just didn't mix with security.
This suspicion of conspiracy to sabotage transport,
said Turl, as he looked around at the wrecked cars with half-lowered eye bones,
could reach to high places.
Zt threw down a wrench with a clang. A low snarl rumbled in him. He sat there, staring in front of him. He was thinking.
What do you really want?
He asked at last.
A recon plane. For 5 or 6 days.
Zt got up and yanked a transport schedule clipboard off the wall and studied it. He could hear Turl almost purring.
You see this schedule?
Said Zt, pushing it under Turl's nose.
Well, yes.
Do you see where it has 6 drone recons assigned to security?
Of course.
And do you see where this has been going on for?
Zt peeled back sheet after sheet.
Blast! For centuries, I suppose.
Have to keep a mineside planet under surveillance,
said Turl complacently.
Under surveillance for what? Said Zt. Every scrap of ore was spotted and estimated long before your and my living memory. There's nothing out there but mammals, air organisms.
There might be a hostile landing.
Here? Sneered Zt. Company probes in outer space would detect it ages before it ever arrived here. Turl, transport has to fuel and maintain and recondition those drones 2 and 3 times a year. You know and I know the company is on an economy wave. Tell you what.
Turl waited sourly to be told.
If you will let us cancel those recon drones, I'll put a tri-wheel ground cycle at your disposal for a limited time.
Turl let out a small, shrill scream. Zt amended his bargain.
A ground car at your disposal when ordered.
Turl lumbered over to the crashed vehicle that had blood on its seats.
Wonder if this was caused by faulty maintenance.
Zt stood there, unrelenting. The crash had been caused by too much Kerbango on duty.
One recon drone programmed to cover the whole planet once a month, said Zt. One ground car at your permanent disposal.
Turl looked at the other wrecks, but couldn't think of anything. These investigations were done and dead. Teach him to close investigations. He wandered back to Zt.
One drone recon programmed to cover the whole planet once a month. One armored and firepower ground car at permanent disposal with no questions on ammunition, breathe gas, or fuel requisitions.
Zt took the forms from the bench drawer and made them out. He shoved the papers and clipboard at Turl. As he signed, Turl thought to himself that this transport chief really ought to be looked into. Maybe for ore robbery.
Zt
took the papers back and removed from the switchboard the combination key card of the oldest and rattiest ground car that was gathering dust in the garage dome. He coupled it with a coupon book for ammo, another for breathe gas, and another for fuel. The deal would never actually become part of recorded history as a deal, for the dates of the orders were carefully not coincident. Neither suspected that they had just materially altered the future of the planet, and not for the better of Intergalactic. But that is sometimes the way with large commercial companies. When Turl had left to get his Mark II armored firepower ground car, Zt thought to himself that it was wonderful what lies executives told just to be able to go hunting. Kill mad they all were. Machine kill mad, too, from the jam-ups he had to repair. What a story. Man, a sentient race indeed. He laughed and got back to work. 7. Johnny Goodboy Tyler galloped free across the vast ocean of grass, Windsplitter exuberantly stretching his legs, the lead horse rollicking along behind. What a day! Blue sky and the wind a cooling freshness on his face. Now, 2 days out, he had come down from the mountains, through the foothills, and into the vastest plain he had ever imagined. He could still see the tiniest tip of High Peak behind him, and with the sun it kept him true on course and reassured him that he could find his way home whenever he wanted. Total security. The herds of wild cattle were many, but he had been living with those all his life. A few wolves, but what were wolves? No bear, no puma so far. Why, in all reverence to the gods, did anybody ever stay cooped up in the mountains? And monsters. What monsters? Pah! Crazy tales. Even that shiny floating cylinder that had gone overhead every few days the whole of his life was overdue down here. It had come from west to east with the regularity of every other heavenly body, but even it seemed to have stopped. On his present course, he would have seen it. In short, Johnny Goodboy Tyler was suffering from a bad case of overconfidence, and the first disaster that hit him had to do with pigs. Pigs were usually easy to kill, if you were a bit nimble and watched out for charges of the boars.